Welcome to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jim Mitchell, your volunteer broadcaster here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. These are the journal's business and finance headlines for Friday, February 21st, 2025. After a strong holiday quarter, Walmart set 2026 fiscal year revenue and profit targets below analyst expectations, sending its stock down 6.5% and pushing the market down as well. The S&P 500 fell 0.4% after ending Wednesday at its third record of 2025. The Dow and NASDAQ retreated 1% and 1.5% respectively. A group of leading indicators gauging the strength of the U.S. economy weakened at the start of the year, reflecting an uncertain outlook at the start of Trump's term. Alibaba's artificial intelligence strategy helped drive third quarter revenue growth to its quickest pace since 2023. A grand jury investigating criminal misconduct at fintech firm Synapse, where customers' funds went missing, questioned an executive who raised alarms before the company collapsed. Major League Baseball and ESPN are ending their media rights partnership, a sign of how legacy TV's decline and streaming's rise are changing the way Americans watch sports. Airbus said it expects to deliver more planes to customers this year than in 2024, despite supply chain snarls. Mercedes-Benz will cut jobs and shift some production from Germany to lower-cost countries, saying it expects earnings to fall significantly this year. And KKR secured a majority stake in Fujisoft and plans to take it private after rival Bain dropped out of a bidding war for the software company. So first, let's take a look at the markets with this article, Dow S&P 500 Fall as Walmart Drops, by Jack Pitcher and Katie Barnato. Major stock indices slid Thursday, with investors unsettled by a note of caution in Walmart's forecast. The U.S.'s biggest retailer posted strong results that met elevated expectations, but investors focused on its weaker-than-expected sales guidance for the coming year. "Wallets are still stretched," said Walmart Chief Executive Officer John David Rainey. Walmart share sank 6.5%. The weaker guidance from the first major retailer to report earnings this year added to concerns about consumer strength that bubbled up after U.S. retail sales fell more than expected in January. Stock indices were lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average led losses, dropping 1%. The S&P 500 retreated after ending Wednesday at its third record high of 2025. The NASDAQ composite closed 0.5% lower. Big bank stocks fell sharply despite no clear news catalyst, which some analysts attributed to economic concerns. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase dropped about 4%, joining with Walmart to drag the Dow Industrials lower. Another market darling faced pressure, with reports of potential U.S. defense budget cuts weighing on Palantir. Shares of the data analyst specialist sold off, extending Wednesday's losses. Meanwhile, President Trump said late Wednesday that a China trade deal was possible. The news failed to boost Chinese stocks or stir the yuan. But Alibaba stock got a fresh boost from a forecasting smashing set of results. Quarterly profit jumped about $6.7 billion, the e-commerce company said. That was almost one-third higher than the consensus forecast of analysts polled by FactSet. Alibaba's American depository receipts jumped 8.1% on Thursday. Elsewhere, U.S. Treasury yields inched lower, with the benchmark 10-year setting at 4.498%. The Japanese yen rallied against the dollar, and the Nikkei 225 fell 1.2%. A former official of the Bank of Japan said it could raise rates in May if the domestic political situation worsens or President Trump's tariffs cause a shock. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index fell 1.6%, led by tech stocks, including device maker Lenovo. Gold rally continued, with futures settling at $2,940 a troy ounce, a record. That was Dow S&P 500 fall as Walmart drops. So let's dig down into that Walmart story with this article. Walmart warns of slower growth in sales, by Sarah Nassauer. Eggs, coffee, gas. The prices Americans pay for everyday items have been stubbornly high, and their search to find savings wherever they can has been surprisingly good for Walmart. But company executives on Thursday set 2026 fiscal year revenue and profit targets below analyst expectations, sending its stock down 6.5% and pushing the market down as well. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1%, or about 450 points, while the S&P 500 dropped 0.4%, and the technology-heavy NASDAQ declined 0.5%. Shares in Target lost 2%, and Costco fell 2.6%. Walmart's forecast raised another red flag, just as mounting trade tensions threatened to drive up the cost of goods, said Jose Torres, senior economist at Interactive Brokers. The discount retailer and country's biggest grocer, best known for its everyday low prices slogan, has been drawing in shoppers of all stripes amid high inflation. They've come to Walmart searching for its store brand food, holiday toys, and even to pick up weight loss medicines at the pharmacy counter. The dynamic boosted U.S. profit and sales at Walmart during the holiday quarter, including a 20% jump in its e-commerce business. The quarterly results, $180.6 billion in revenue and $7.9 billion in operating income, met Wall Street's elevated expectations. Walmart has enjoyed a post-pandemic streak that pushed the company's stock near all-time highs and lifted its market valuation above $800 billion this year. But U.S. Walmart shoppers are acting basically the same they have been for several quarters, with cautious but steady spending. Wallets are still stretched, John David Rainey, Walmart's chief executive officer, said in an interview. In Walmart's Mexico business, tariff talks had caused fears and some additional shopper pullback, he said. Walmart has used its negotiating power with suppliers to offer lower prices than smaller competitors, and its heft to invest in store pickup and grocery delivery service that have helped its market share from weaker competitors such as Target and dollar store chains. Our prices are low, and we're becoming more efficient, said Chief Executive Doug McMillon on an investor call on Thursday. Customers and members are going to be looking for value. They're going to be looking for convenience. The strategy will be tested this year after the Trump administration imposed fresh tariffs on many goods that Walmart imports from China and has pledged to add tariffs that would boost cost on goods from elsewhere. Walmart is going to work really hard to keep prices low as tariffs increase, Rainey said. The company feels prepared to manage through an environment of tariff increases, he said. We're not immune to what's being suggested, but we'll work with suppliers, Rainey said. Walmart didn't incorporate tariff increases into its financial expectations for the year, he said. To start the year, executives set targets for fiscal 2026 that would come in below where it finished fiscal 2025, where revenue ended up rising 5.1% and operating income rose 8.6%. They're expecting fiscal revenue growth of 3 to 4% and operating income improving at a faster clip than sales. Those figures were somewhat cautious, said Rainey on the call with analysts. We have to acknowledge that we're in an uncertain time and we don't want to get out over our skis here, he said. The company's projections would put its fiscal 2026 adjusted per share earnings in a range of $2.50 to $2.60, compared with Wall Street's earnings estimate of about $2.77 a share for the year. The company's initial forecast for fiscal 2026, especially in its earnings target for the current quarter, are below the expectations of investors that had been piling into the stock, said Ivan Holman, an analyst for Bernstein. Investors were bracing for conservative guidance, but this is a more muted outlook than investor feedback into earnings had suggested, Holman said. While some investors were disappointed by the company's outlook, analysts said the latest quarterly results showed how Walmart has been able to build upon its business by wooing wealthier shoppers and taking pages from Amazon's playbook to pad its profits with an advertising business and membership program. With its investments in fulfillment and home delivery, it's perhaps the only retailer capable of competing with Amazon's online experience, said Blake Droscher, senior analyst at eMarketer. Walmart said it was seeing broad-based gains with U.S. shoppers looking for deals, especially among higher-income households, a group Walmart defines as households that earn $100,000 a year or more. That gain was especially strong for non-grocery items, driven by the convenience of same-day delivery services, Rainey said. Those gains came as prices in the U.S. ticked up at Walmart, especially for frequently bought items such as eggs and meat, and more shoppers embraced the retailer's store brands compared with last year, the company said. Store brands are generally priced lower than national brands. Walmart's U.S. comparable sales, those from stores and digital channels operating for at least 1 year, rose 4.6% in the three-month period ended January 31st. Walmart analysts expected a 4.4% gain in that closely watched metric. That was Walmart warns of slower growth in sales. So let's stick with a look at the economy with this item. Leading Indicators Pare Back Gains by Ed Frankel. A group of measures judging the strength of the U.S. economy ahead weakened at the start of the year, reflecting an uncertain outlook at the start of President Trump's term. The Leading Indicator Index, or LEI, published Thursday by the Conference Board Research Group, dropped 0.3% in January, following an upwardly revised 0.1% increase in December, reversing most of the gains of the past 2 months. Economists polled by the Wall Street Journal expected a 0.2% downtick. Consumers' assessments of future business conditions turned more pessimistic in January, which, alongside fewer weekly hours worked in manufacturing, drove the monthly decline, the Conference Board's Justina Zabinska-LaMonica said. However, the LEI's six-month and annual growth rates trended upward, she said. The economy is now expected to expand by 2.3% in 2025, albeit with stronger growth in the first half of the year, she noted. That was Leading Indicators Pare Back Gains. Next, Alibaba's Revenue Surges by Tracy Chu, Shen Liu, and Rafaela Huang. Alibaba Group's artificial intelligence strategy helped drive third-quarter revenue growth to its quickest pace since late 2023, and the e-commerce company weathered fierce domestic competition and a slowing Chinese economy. The Hangzhou company on Thursday reported a 7.6% rise in revenue to 280 billion yuan, equivalent to 38.5 billion U.S. dollars, the fastest pace since the September quarter of 2023, and beating analyst estimates supported by an improvement in its e-commerce and AI businesses. The company's American depository receipts rose 8.1% Thursday in New York after the results. Chief Executive Eddie Wu said in the results reflected substantial progress in Alibaba's first user AI-driven strategies and the resumption of strong growth in its core businesses. In a call with investors, Wu said that in the next 3 years, Alibaba's investment in cloud computing and AI infrastructure is expected to exceed the total investment of the past decade. The company will also scale up R&D investment in AI foundational models and the development of AI-enabled applications to train other areas of the business. The AI era presents a clear and massive demand for infrastructure. We will aggressively invest in AI infrastructure, Wu said. Alibaba has been navigating a cooling Chinese economy and rising competition from ByteDance's short video app Douyin, PDD's Pinduoduo commerce platform, and others. Investors have been closely watching the progress of its AI-powered marketing tools for merchants, Quanzhan Tui, a key measure to accelerate monetization of Alibaba's e-commerce business. Customer management revenue at Taobao and the Tmall Group, a metric gauging how much money Alibaba earned from merchants, rose 9% for the 3 months ended in December, compared with 3 months in the earlier quarter. In a sign that the tech private sector is back in China's favor, Beijing this week signaled to business leaders that it needs to help to drive economic growth and self-sufficiency. Alibaba founder Jack Ma, who has been largely absent from public view in recent years, attended the meeting where President Xi Jinping indicated the change on Monday. Alibaba has devoted significant effort to developing AI technology, offering a conversational chatbot service, Qwen, as its representative product. Alibaba co-founder Joe Tsai last week said its AI technology would be integrated into Apple's iPhones for China, a move that analysts expect to burnish the Chinese titan brand image and benefit its long-term growth. Wu didn't discuss the Apple initiative on Thursday. Net profit for the last quarter was a better-than-expected 48.945 billion won, more than tripling from a year earlier. Adjusted net profit, which excludes the effects of share-based compensation expenses, investment gains and losses, some impairments and other items, rose 6.5% to 51.07 billion won. Sales at Alibaba's core domestic e-commerce business, Taobao and Tmall Group, rose 5.4% to 136.09 billion won. Alibaba's cloud computing unit reported a 13% increase in sales to 31.74 billion won. The company's fast-expanding overseas commerce unit posted a 32% rise in revenue to 37.76 billion won. That was Alibaba's revenue growth surges. Let's turn from China to Silicon Valley with this story. Synapse executive disclosed missing funds by Alexander Saidi. A grand jury is investigating criminal misconduct at a Silicon Valley fintech firm where customers' funds went missing and has questioned an executive who raised alarms before the company collapsed, people familiar with the matter said. Synapse connected financial technology firms with banks, helping startups that marketed flashy savings apps find a place to park their digital customers' funds. The middleman managed billions of dollars at its peak before its sudden collapse in April left thousands of people unable to access their money. The court-appointed mediator later disclosed that as much as $96 million in customer funds managed by Synapse might be missing, and some people have reported losing their life savings. The scandal is now in the crosshairs of federal prosecutors in New York. Victor Medeiros, who was a senior director at Synapse's finance department, was subpoenaed in November as part of a criminal investigation into fraud and other possible felonies, according to court records published in January. In 2023, Medeiros had told Synapse's accountants, Kroll, that there was a shortfall of millions of dollars from customers' accounts, people familiar with the matter said. He said the gap was the result of Synapse keeping some of the funds for itself. The debacle has been a wake-up call for customers using smartphone apps that market themselves as alternatives to traditional savings accounts, promising above-market interest rates and deposit insurance. Even though Synapse's bank partners are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, the banks aren't the ones that failed, so deposit insurance doesn't apply for the customers whose funds have gone missing. Synapse's chief executive has accused its primary bank partner, Evolve Bank, of mishandling customer funds. Evolve has said the fault lies with Synapse. Evolve Bank normally paid Synapse interest on the deposits it held at the bank, much like any bank would. Synapse would then take a cut of that payment as a fee and allocate the rest to customers who are earning interest on their savings through apps like Yoda and Yield Street. About a year before Synapse's bankruptcy, Medeiros told Kroll that the firm hadn't been filling customer accounts with the full interest they were due, leaving them more than $3 million short as of the middle of 2023, people familiar with the matter have said. He transferred some of Synapse's own funds to try to bridge the gap, but told Kroll that there was still a $3 million shortfall, some of the people said. Kroll employees checked Synapse's books and informed its board that Medeiros' estimated shortfall was accurate, the people familiar with the matter said. The board demanded the shortfall be immediately fixed, but Synapse was already running out of money and said it couldn't cover all the losses. In a letter dated September 27, 2023, Synapse CEO Sankeet Pathak wrote to Evolve Bank executives that, quote, it appears that Synapse may have incorrectly received $3.25 million from customers' accounts, according to a copy of the email reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. He asked the bank to help cover some of the shortfall, according to the email. Evolve was in the midst of a deepening dispute with Synapse, but agreed to cover about half of the shortfall, according to a copy of a contract between the companies reviewed by the journal. Synapse covered the other half of the shortfall, people familiar with the matter said. Angela Strange, a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz, left Synapse's board shortly after the incident, people familiar with the matter said. Executives from Evolve and Synapse still suspected there were millions more in missing customer funds and spent the next several months trying to get a grasp on the scale of the problem, the journal said. Kroll never finished its work auditing Synapse's finances because Synapse ran out of money to pay for its work. Kroll declined to comment. The grand jury is investigating the specifics of the $3 million shortfall, as well as other issues, including some $26 million in card fees that Evolve charged directly from Synapse customer accounts, a person familiar with the matter said. It is also homing in on specific communications from Synapse executives. That was Synapse executive disclosed missing funds. Next. Let's turn to aerospace with this article, Airbus Sees More 2025 Deliveries, by Mauro Ori. Airbus said it expects to deliver more planes to customers this year than in 2024, betting that it can produce enough aircraft to keep up with demand, even as supply chain snarls continue to plague its manufacturing operations. The European plane maker is forecasting roughly 820 commercial aircraft deliveries this year, more than the 766 planes it dispatched in 2024. Airbus was expected to deliver 824 this year, according to consensus estimates by Visible Alpha. The company anticipates a slow start to the year in terms of deliveries, as some aircraft can't be fully assembled because of delays with engine shipments from some suppliers. However, it expects an improvement in the second half of the year. Airbus has faced challenges in recent years in sourcing components and materials to produce aircraft and deliver them to customers on schedule. The group had initially aimed to ship out roughly 800 planes last year, but it lowered that target in June to 770 due to difficulties in procuring engines, aerostructures, and cabin equipment. Its U.S. rival Boeing delivered 348 planes last year, down from 528 the previous year. Boeing has also been grappling with supply chain hurdles on top of a debilitating machinist strike that had halted production of most airplanes. The U.S. company has been under renewed pressure to ensure safety and quality in its manufacturing operations after last year's Alaska Airlines emergency landing that involved one of its jets. Airbus said supply chain challenges, particularly with Spirit AeroSystems holdings, were putting pressure on plans to ramp up production of its A220 narrowbody and A350 widebody aircraft. The jet fuselage supplier, which split off from Boeing about two decades ago, has been at the center of quality issues affecting 737 MAX jets. Spirit AeroSystems made the fuselage involved in the Alaska Airlines blowout. Airbus said it still expects to produce 14 of its A220 aircraft a month in 2026 and 75 A320 narrowbody planes a month in 2027. It also expects to produce around four A330 planes a month, though it didn't provide a date. For its bigger model, the company continues to target 12 A350s a month in 2028. However, the group said it was delaying the entry into service of the A350 freighter variant to the second half of 2027 from 2026 previously. Chief Executive Guillaume Ferry said in an earnings call that Airbus had started talks with Italy's Leonardo and France's Thales to explore consolidation options in the European space sector to gain scale to better compete with big U.S. companies like Elon Musk's SpaceX. Talks are preliminary and non-binding at this stage, he said. Ferry said, securing a significant stake in a business with other groups would be a good outcome for Airbus. Leonardo and Thales are in a joint venture known as Thales Alenia Space that makes satellites. Airbus posted revenue of 24.72 billion euros, equivalent to 25.95 billion U.S. dollars for the 3 months, ended in December, up 8% year over year. Net profit jumped to 66% to 2.42 billion euros, while adjusted earnings before interest and taxes, Airbus's preferred measure of profitability, grew 16% to 2.56 billion euros. Analysts had expected revenue of 24.68 billion, a net profit of nearly 2.1 billion, and adjusted EBIT of 2.6 billion euros, according to market consensus provided by the company based on estimates from 22 analysts. Airbus said it would propose a 2024 dividend of 2 euros a share and a special dividend of 1 euro a share. Last year, the company proposed a dividend of 1.8 euros a share and a special dividend of 1 euro a share. For 2025, Airbus said it expects adjusted EBIT of around 7 billion euros. Free cash flow before customer financing, a closely watched metric by analysts and investors, is projected at around 4.5 billion euros. The group said its guidance excluded the impact of potential new tariffs, as well as future disruptions to trade, air traffic, and supply chains. That was Airbus Sees More 2025 Deliveries. You're listening to The Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you miss any part of this program, or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Now, let's go to our next article. ESPN and Baseball to End Long-Term TV Deal by Isabella Simonetti and Jared Diamond. Major League Baseball and Walt Disney's ESPN are ending their media rights partnership after more than three decades. A sign of how legacy TV's decline and streaming's ascendance are changing the way Americans watch sports. The league and ESPN said Thursday that they plan to end their current deal after the 2025 season. ESPN was due to pay the league $550 million a year from 2026 to 2028 for the rights to air 30 regular season games a season, as well as the annual Home Run Derby and Wild Card playoff round. Years of cord-cutting have upended the economics of entertainment, prompting media companies to reevaluate some of their spending. Disney is working to improve the profitability of its direct-to-consumer business and transition ESPN to a streaming future while being prudent with its sports deals, making high-profile packages like the National Basketball Association rights priorities. ESPN made an aggressive effort to reduce fees, the MLB commissioner Bob Manfred told team owners on Thursday in a letter seen by the Wall Street Journal. The sports giant sought terms that were more comparable to what Apple and Roku pay in their rights deals, a request that the league rejected. That was ESPN and baseball to end long-term TV deal. Next, KKR secures majority stake in Fujisoft by Kosokoro Narioka. KKR has secured a majority stake in Fujisoft and plans to take the company private just days after rival Bain Capital dropped out of a months-long bidding war for the Japanese software company, valued at more than $4 billion. KKR announced Thursday that it would become the largest shareholder with a 58% stake following a successful tender offer and plans to acquire the remaining shares through a squeeze-out process. Foreign equity firms like KKR and Bain Capital have been riding a growing wave of Japanese mergers and acquisitions in recent years as large companies spin off non-core businesses or management choose to leave the public market. Earlier this month, KKR raised its tender offer price to 9,850 yen, equivalent to $65.03 per share, from 9,451 yen in an attempt to end the takeover battle and also extend the tender offer period through Wednesday. In November, KKR acquired more than one-third of Fujisoft's shares, securing shares held by two major shareholders, 3D Investment Partners and Farallon Capital Management. We're fully committed and look forward to supporting Fujisoft's plan to enhance its corporate value under a new and simpler ownership by KKR, said Hiro Hirano, deputy executive chairman of KKR Asia Pacific. KKR estimates the minimum ownership stake required to conduct a squeeze-out will be around 53% based on past voting patterns. A shareholders' meeting for the squeeze-out process is scheduled for April. Fujisoft had nearly 18,000 employees at the end of 2023 and provides information technology services to clients across a wide range of industries. In 2024, the company's operating profit rose 6.5% to 22 billion yen, equivalent to 145.2 million U.S. dollars, as revenue grew 6.2% to 307 billion yen, Fujisoft said last week. Bain Capital said Monday it decided not to begin a tender offer for the software company after consulting with Fujisoft founder Hiroshi Nozawa, who intended to take the company private with Bain Capital. The U.S. private equity firm said in December that it planned to start a tender offer at 9,600 yen a share once certain conditions were met. Bain Capital's wish for the continued growth of Fujisoft under the renewed governance by the new shareholders, it said Monday. That was KKR secures majority stake in Fujisoft. Next, Mercedes to cut jobs as earnings slump by Dominic Chopping. Mercedes-Benz will cut jobs and shift some production from its German home to lower-cost countries as it prepares for another challenging year. After reporting a sharp drop in earnings in 2024, the company said it also expected earnings to fall significantly this year. At an investor event on Thursday, it outlined plans to boost competitiveness that includes a 10% cut to production costs over the next couple of years. While it ruled out shutting down any German plants, Mercedes will seek cost reductions by cutting capacity in the country, instead shifting more manufacturing to lower-cost countries such as Hungary. German headcount will also come down, with the company planning voluntary redundancy programs, while employees leaving the company through the natural attrition process won't be replaced. It didn't provide details of how many jobs will be cut. To ensure the company's future competitiveness in an increasingly uncertain world, we're taking steps to make the company leaner, faster, and stronger, while readying an intense product launch campaign for multiple new vehicles, said Chief Executive Olaf Kalanius. European automakers have been scrambling to boost their competitiveness as they navigate stuttering demand for electric vehicles and intense competition in China, while the struggling Chinese economy also has seen buyers shy away from luxury spending. At the same time, manufacturers face the prospects of an escalating global trade war as the threat of tariffs on cars imported to the U.S. also hang over the industry. The German luxury carmaker said that to counter the tough Chinese market, a key region that accounts for around one-third of its car sales, it would spend considerable time and resources to defend and build its position in the country over the next 5 years. This won't involve compromising on pricing, but the company said it would use more local suppliers, optimize its production to look using China more as a research and development base, and to tap into the talent pool there. China is the most intense market in the world, Kalanius said at the investor event. China has to be home away from home. It could also localize more production in the U.S. from Europe following President Trump's threat of imposing 25% tariffs on imported vehicles. As part of the company's plans to boost growth over the next few years, it said it would launch dozens of new or refreshed models that would reach markets through 2027. Most of those will be new top-end combustion engine cars, as sales of the more traditionally powered vehicles continue to outstrip demand for EVs and would also bring higher margins. In addition, through unifying some aspect of its technology and design, it will be able to tailor products to specific markets such as China, it said. The company reported a 41% drop in earnings in its car unit last year on lower volumes, particularly in China, negative net pricing, and unfavorable model mix. It expects to slightly sell fewer cars and vans this year compared with 2024, while its adjusted return on sales margin in the car unit is guided at 6-8% compared with 8.1% in 2024. It targets a margin of at least 10% from 2027. Group revenue in 2025 will be slightly below the prior year level, and group earnings before interest and taxes are expected to be significantly lower. Group free cash flow from the industrial business is also seen slightly below the strong level of 2024, it said. Mercedes lowered its dividend to €4.3, or $4.48 a share, from €5.3 in 2023, and it decided on share buybacks of up to €5 billion over a period of up to 24 months. Fourth quarter net profit fell to €2.48 billion from €3.12 billion a year earlier, as revenue declined 3.8% to €38.45 billion. Analysts polled by FactSet expected net profit to come in at €2.42 billion on revenue of €38.12 billion. First quarter car sales volumes are expected at about the same level as the first quarter of last year, with the margin estimated at between 6-8%, it said. That was Mercedes to cut jobs as earnings slump. Let's move to a slightly lighter note with this article, When Null Is Your Name, Nothing Works, by Oyin Adedoyin. Nantra Yantapraysert couldn't wait to take her husband's shorter and easier to pronounce last name. She didn't know what kind of problems it would cause. Her last name is Null, N-U-L-L, the same word used by computer scientists to mean no value or invalid value. The Nulls of the world, it turns out, endure a lifetime of website bounce backs, processing errors, and declarations of customer service representatives that their accounts don't exist. After becoming a Null, she was due to travel to India in 2014 on a non-refundable flight for a friend's marriage, but her visa hadn't arrived in the mail. The Indian consulate told her it had tried multiple times, but the computer system wouldn't process her last name, she said. A week before the wedding, she was still waiting. I had to mentally come to terms with not being able to go, said Nantra, a 41-year-old clothing designer in Burbank, California. She finally received the documents the day before her flight. Since then, she's come up with workarounds to ease the burden of being a Null. Null was first programmed 60 years ago by a British computer scientist named Tony Hoare. It has since been incorporated into many of the systems that make commerce run, from hotel reservations to government agency forms. Some progress has been made toward addressing the glitch, but Nulls still face challenges. Just last year, officials learned that the revamped free application for federal student aid couldn't process forms from people with the last name Null. The issue was fixed in October. In some systems, blocking the word is a security feature, said Vahid Bazidan, a computer science professor at the University of New Haven. In these cases, the system perceives the word as a potential attack or attempt at sabotage and will block its entry. Hoare probably wasn't thinking about people with the 4,910th most common surname. He later called it his billion-dollar mistake, given the amount of programmer time it has used up and the damage it's inflicted on the user experience. It's a difficult problem to solve because it's so widespread, said Don Lajan, a researcher at Microsoft, who said the company avoids the use of null values in its software. These days, Nantra Null sometimes uses her maiden name instead of her last name. Other times, she puts a hyphen between the two. But she still gets packages and letters delivered at her work for people who aren't in the company system. The names are automatically assigned as Null, which is associated with Nantra in the system, so the mail gets to her desk. Jan Null, a 75-year-old meteorologist in Half Moon Bay, California, now adds his first initial to his last name when making online hotel reservations. Sometimes that's the only way to trick the system into reading Null as a series of individual letters instead of a code. Last year, he struggled to reserve a room. He would just type his first name, last name, and email, then get bounced back to the first step like he hadn't entered anything at all. When he called for help, hotel workers were stumped. He said, let's try making your name something different, Jan remembers them suggesting. Even those without the last name Null are finding themselves caught in the void. Joseph Totaro got a license plate with the word Null on it nearly 10 years ago. The 36-year-old security auditor thought it would be funny to drive around with a symbol for an empty value. Maybe a police officer who tried to give him a ticket would end up writing null into the system and not be able to process it, he joked to himself. In 2018, he paid a $38 parking ticket. Soon afterward, he said, his mailbox was flooded with hundreds of traffic tickets for incidents he hadn't been involved in. The tickets were from other countries and cities for vehicles of different colors, makes, and models. A database has associated the word null with his personal information, and citations were sent to Tartaro, who lives in Los Angeles. Computer software systems have evolved to avoid null, said Lesion from Microsoft, who contributed research to one of these systems. But companies are sometimes hesitant to adopt new systems or to give up the convenience of their old ones, he said. Morgan Null, a 26-year-old attorney in Pittsburgh, said her cousin had struggled to get her teaching license because of their shared last name. So Morgan wasn't surprised when Null presented problems in a recent move. Representatives for the internet provider she used in her old apartment initially told her they couldn't cancel her account because there was no last name associated with it. She'd been paying the company for months. She has since switched internet providers. That was When Null Is Your Name, Nothing Works. And now, let's turn to the opinion pages of the journal and begin with this item. Trump's executive power restoration. In case you haven't noticed, President Trump is trying to assert control over the entire executive branch of government, for better or worse. His latest effort is an executive order published Tuesday that imposes new White House supervision over so-called independent agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission. This would be constitutional watershed. The federal government includes dozens of agencies that are nominally independent of the president, even though they enforce the laws and exercise other executive power. This wasn't part of the original constitutional design. Such agencies took root during the Progressive Era in the early 20th century. Woodrow Wilson, in particular, disliked the Constitution and wanted government by bureaucratic experts shielded from political control. Thus evolved today's government alphabet soup of the SEC, FCC, FTC, FEC, FCTC, CFPB, FERC, FDIC, the Federal Reserve, and many more. A century of evidence refutes Wilson's premise, and Mr. Trump is now challenging it head on. His argument, echoed by many modern conservative scholars, is that insulation from presidential authority runs counter to Article II's command for the president, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. If Congress has charged such agencies with enforcing laws, then the president should be able to supervise how they do that job. As Mr. Trump's order explains, previous administrations have allowed so-called independent regulatory agencies to operate with minimal presidential supervision. These regulatory agencies currently exercise substantial executive authority without sufficient accountability to the president and through him to the American people. No more. His order requires these agencies to submit proposed and final rules to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the White House. The OIRA, which is part of the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, will review rules to ensure their cost-benefit and legal analysis is rigorous and that they hew to Mr. Trump's priorities. His order notably includes the Fed's financial regulation, though not its interest rate or monetary policy functions. Mr. Trump's order also states that OMB, quote, shall establish performance standards and management objectives for independent agency heads and adjust their funding by activity, function, project, or object as necessary and appropriate to advance the president's policies and priorities. This will give the president enormous leverage over agency leaders and their priorities. OMB could block agency money for rulemaking or enforcement activities, say crypto regulation, that don't jibe with Mr. Trump's policies. Progressives are calling this a power grab. But if so, it's restoring the vision of the founders who gave the president control over the executive branch. Today, that control can be divided, as it is on antitrust policy, for example. The Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department both enforce antitrust and consumer protection laws. But the Attorney General answers to the president, while the FTC chair doesn't. This makes no logical governing sense. Mr. Trump's order also has the virtue of making clear that increasingly these independent agencies aren't really independent. After Barack Obama endorsed regulating broadband providers as common carriers, his FCC chair, Tom Wheeler, promulgated a net neutrality rule that did so. Does anyone believe Mr. Wheeler was acting independently, or that the FTC sued Meta at the end of Mr. Trump's first term without the president's blessing? Joe Biden issued executive orders encouraging various independent agencies to consider issuing regulations, for instance, an FTC ban on non-compete agreements. They followed his orders. He also added agency heads to the White House policy councils to coordinate with cabinet departments. Mr. Trump's order is, in that sense, truth in advertising. The larger significance of all of this is political accountability. The president is elected and thus accountable to the public in a way the head of agencies aren't. Yet these bureaucracies have vast power over lives and livelihoods of Americans. When they exceed their authority, a president should be able to hear and represent public complaints. The Trump order, therefore, may be his most important for the future of U.S. governance. It seems designed to tee up a legal challenge that gives the Supreme Court an opportunity to revisit its rulings back to the 1930s that upheld the constitutionality of independent agencies. The justices most recently danced around this in the Celia Law in 2020 when they struck down removal of protections for the director of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Congress would still have its power of the purse, oversight, and advice and consent over nominees. A unitary executive might even persuade Congress to write clearer laws and retake some of the powers it has ceded to the executive, on trade, for example. The great constitutional issue at stake here is political accountability in a government of separated powers. That was Trump's executive power restoration. Next, Trump's Myth of the Trade Deficit by Phil Graham and Donald Boudreau. Mr. Graham, a former chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, is a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Boudreau is a professor of economics at George Mason University and the Mercantis Center. This article is based on their forthcoming book, The Triumph of Economic Freedom, Debunking the Seven Great Myths of American Capitalism. It seems to be a matter of faith among protectionists that trade deficits make the U.S. an economic loser. President Trump considers America's trade imbalances with Canada, Mexico, and China a matter of grave concern. At the same time, since taking office, he's announced several ambitious plans to increase foreign investment in the U.S. economy. The commitment to both eliminate trade deficits and to pursue foreign investment shows the inconsistency of the Trump administration's policy. Trade deficits and capital surpluses are two sides of the same coin. The value of the dollar is set on the foreign exchange market, where the daily trading volume is $6.6 trillion U.S. dollars. Americans exchange dollars for foreign currencies to buy goods and services from abroad and engage in foreign capital transactions. Likewise, foreign entities and individuals exchange their money for dollars to buy American goods and services and invest in the U.S. If for a nanosecond the supply and demand for dollars are not equal, the value of the dollar changes to bring them into balance. Therefore, if the U.S. has a surplus in its capital accounts balance, it must have a corresponding deficit in the trade balance. Protectionists can't turn the tides of markets. If Japanese tech investing firm SoftBank fulfills its December 16th commitment to invest $100 billion in the U.S., as SoftBank acquires dollars to fund the investment, the value of the dollar will rise relative to what it would have been without the investment, The cost of U.S. exports will also rise, the cost of U.S. imports will fall, and the country's trade deficit will rise. Fortunately, foreign capital investment creates American jobs and fuels economic growth no less than do foreign purchases of American exports. Trade deficits don't stifle growth, nor do trade surpluses foster it. In the 29 years after the end of World War II, during which the U.S. had a virtual monopoly on heavy manufacturing and regularly ran trade surpluses, a real per capita gross domestic product grew 2.1% a year. Over the next 29 years, from 1976 through 2004, the U.S. ran chronic trade deficits, and the average annual growth rate of real per capita GDP was virtually identical at 2.2%. During the Reagan administration, as economic growth surged, foreign investment flooded into the country and the trade deficit soared. The trade deficit similarly grew during the economic boom of the Clinton administration. In the high growth years from 1998 to 2001, when the federal government ran a budget surplus, the annual trade deficit more than doubled. And when economic growth ramped up in 2017 and 2018 due to Mr. Trump's deregulation and tax cuts, foreign investment surged and the trade deficit rose despite Mr. Trump's 2018 tariffs. During 102 of the 120 months of the Great Depression, the U.S. ran trade surpluses. From 1900 to 1929, years of high economic growth, it also ran trade surpluses. From 1830 to 1860 and 1870 to 1890, when average tariff rates on imports were falling and the rate of industrialization was rapidly increasing, the U.S. generally ran trade deficits in goods and services. Between 1890 and 2024, it's impossible to find a statistically significant correlation between America's trade balance and its economic growth. Has the expansion of global trade hollowed out U.S. manufacturing, as Joe Biden claimed in 2022? No. U.S. industrial production today is more than double what it was in 1975, the last time we ran a trade surplus. It's 55% higher than in 1994, when the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect. And it's 18% higher than it was when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. Real wages are up 19% from 1994 and 10% from 2001. The inflation-adjusted value of America's capital stock is 36% higher today than it was in 2001, 66% higher than 1994, and 178% higher than it was in 1975. Mr. Trump and Congress should focus on advancing economic growth by deregulating, controlling the budget deficit, and extending the 2017 tax cuts. Fixating on the trade deficit, an imagined problem, will only draw the nation into a trade war that could overpower the positive effects of the Trump economic program. That was Trump's myth of the trade deficit. And that brings us to the end of today's Wall Street Journal for Friday, February 21st, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.